Welcome to NPR Movies, a weekly sampler of movie love from your friends here at NPR. This week, a biopic of B.I.G. A biopic of the rapper Notorious B.I.G. Also, cinematic blacks who paved the way for the new president. But first, an economic story of sorts. I'll let NPR's Michelle Norris and Bob Mondello explain.
Inflation for 2008 was lower than it's been in 50 years. The Labor Department said today that consumer prices only went up 0.1%. But the average price of a movie ticket went up approximately 4%. That got our film critic, Bob Mondello, thinking. Bob says the amount of money in the wallets of movie audiences is often reflected in movie titles.
It started with a dumb joke. I was looking at my 401k and seeing desolation, emptiness, a parched landscape, and mumbling to myself about how my fistful of dollars was becoming a fistful of dimes.
You can't get rich like that. At most, you will only succeed in being killed.
Truer words never spoken. Maybe I should have invested overseas so I'd at least have a fistful of euros. Which led me to wonder what Clint Eastwood's fistful of 1964 dollars would be worth now. So I checked with the Bureau of Labor Statistics. Each 1964 dollar would now have the buying power of almost $7. Well, you know where that took me. 1974's $6 million man would cost $25 million to build now. Those romance-starved secretaries who threw 3 coins in the fountain, they'd have to throw 24 coins today. And while diamonds are still the girl's best friend, about the only other commodity holding its value is that precious metal that 007 worked so hard to protect from... what was his name again?
Goldfinger.
Right. Platinum finger just doesn't sing. But as I kept looking at movie titles, I stopped turning pennies into nickels from heaven and started thinking about what the titles meant to audiences back then. The first money title I could find was from the days of storefront Nickelodeons, an 1897 half-minute short called Scrambling for Pennies, a title perfect for audiences who'd recently survived the panic of 1893. And for a couple of decades after that, silent films often had titles like His Last Dollar and The $5 Baby. But in the 1920s, the stock market zoomed, and Hollywood sent titles zooming too. Million Dollar Mystery, for instance, though there was also Her Fatal Millions, Vanishing Millions, Melting Millions, as if screenwriters could see the stock market crash coming. And sure enough, after 1929, you start getting titles like Dollar Dizzy, Too Many Millions, and Million Dollar Swindle. Also a whole set of down-and-out titles like The Nickel Nurser and A Dime a Dance. Now, let's note that what I'm doing here is the world's least scientific survey. I haven't gone back to watch these pictures to see what they're about, but their titles do say something about the public's moody relationship with money. There are about 100 titles containing the words million dollar, for instance, and while there are a few from every decade, they tend to cluster when times are good, as do other phrases. Take the title Money Talks. In 1997, it was attached to a flick starring Chris Tucker as a small-time con man.
Oh, wait a minute. You talking about the money? The money that I owe you. I'm gonna pay you, man. Look at me, man. You know I'm gonna pay you.
That's 1997, but Money Talks had long been a popular title. There had been films called Money Talks in the 20s, 30s, 40s, 50s. But intriguingly, the title fell out of fashion during the mid-1970s, when the U.S. was experiencing high interest rates and inflation. In other words, when people thought money kind of didn't talk, Money Talks didn't strike producers as a good title. Those same inflationary years instead brought titles like Take the Money and Run and Billion Dollar Bubble. Also Tango and Cash, but I don't think that means much. So what's the trend going to be from here? Well, Hollywood seems optimistic. Nicole Kidman recently bought the rights to 1953's How to Marry a Millionaire, apparently because she wants to play the Marilyn Monroe part.
Do you know who I'd like to marry?
Who?
Rockefeller.
Which one?
I don't care.
For the record, to match Marilyn's catch from 1953, Nicole Kidman will need to marry a millionaire worth at least $8 million. I'm Bob Mondello.
Notorious is the name of a new biopic about the life and early death of the rap star, the Notorious B.I.G. It's co-produced by his friends, by people involved in his music, and his mother. It portrays Christopher Wallace as a complicated character, a young Brooklyn hustler, then a budding rap star who was very close to his mom.
Christopher, are you not still lying in that bed, are you?
No.
Christopher, what are you doing?
Oh, you saying your prayers?
Praying that God teaches you how to knock.
Please, don't you mock your prayers.
You don't think Jehovah has a sense of humor?
He must have, if he made you.
We always gotta listen to this corny old country music.
I happen to like this music. They tell good stories.
The film Notorious opens today. Reporter Corey Takahashi visited the site of the rapper's murder in Los Angeles, and he went along with the writers of the movie.
This is the site of one of L.A.'s most famous unsolved murders. It's the intersection of Wilshire Boulevard and Fairfax Avenue, home to the L.A. County Museum of Art and the Peterson Automotive Museum. In 1997, the notorious B.I.G. was leaving a party here. The driver of a Chevy Impala pulled alongside his mobile convoy, pulled out a pistol, and fired.
It really was like the shot that was heard around the world in terms of hip-hop.
Reggie Rock Bythewood co-wrote the screenplay for Notorious with Chael Hadari Coker. Coker had followed the rapper's rise in the hip-hop world, reported on his murder for the L.A. Times, and was the last journalist to interview him at length.
We used to fuss when the landlord dissed us. No heat, wonder why Christmas missed us. Birthdays was the worst days. Now we sip champagne when we thirsty. Damn right, I like the life I live, cause I went from negative to positive, and it's all.
How does a Catholic school kid who's a straight-A student become a drug dealer, almost by accident become a rap legend, go through all the trials and tribulations of being a superstar, and then right when at the moment he gets it all together, it just gets snapped away?
More than a decade after his death, his music still resonates. On a recent afternoon, Marlon Blakely was getting off a bus near the 1997 murder scene.
He wasn't just a hardcore rapper. People loved him. The women loved him, you know. He even say I'm ugly. Like he even say, I'm ugly as ever.
However,
I stay Gucci down to the socks.
However, I stay Gucci down to the socks. Rings and watch filled with rocks. And my jam knocking your Mitsubishi. Girls pee-pee when they see me. Navajos creep me and they teepee. As I lay down laws like Island Coffee. Stop it. If you think you're gonna make a profit. Don't see my ones, don't see my guns. Get it? Now tell your friends, Papa, hit it.
Screenwriter Coker says the Notorious B.I.G.'s lyrics continue to distinguish him from other rap stars.
He's relevant to hip-hop in the same way that Charlie Parker or John Coltrane is relevant to jazz, or the way that Michael Jordan or Dr. J are still relevant to basketball. Doesn't mean that other people aren't playing ball every day. It just means that he put a mark on it and a certain signature that is just indelible.
His influence echoes throughout the work of pop stars like Sean Diddy Combs, his former producer, as well as Jay-Z, a fellow Brooklynite who's carried forth the B.I.G. formula of wit, verve, and humor. But B.I.G. celebrity in the mid-90s came with what the rapper called mo' money, mo' problems. Screenwriter Reggie Rock Bythewood.
This was still at the height of this media-induced East Coast-West Coast war between East Coast rappers and West Coast rappers.
Tupac Shakur represented the Wild West Coast sound. B.I.G. was East Coast tradition, and what had been a competition for record sales took on a menacing tone after the California superstar, Tupac, was robbed and shot at a New York recording studio in 1994. Tupac suspected that members of the Notorious B.I.G.'s camp were involved. In 1996, Tupac was shot again, fatally, in Las Vegas. 6 months later, the Notorious B.I.G. traveled to L.A. to promote and work on music, and to try to ease tensions between the East and West Coasts. That's when he was killed. The movie Notorious trends toward the positive. It doesn't ignore gritty aspects of his 24 years, but it's clearly the perspective of family, friends, and fans. Chael Hadari Coker says one key chapter of the story remains open.
I hope, if anything, this movie spurs interest to demand his murder be solved.
So far, this is one L.A. story without a clean Hollywood ending. For NPR News, I'm Corey Takahashi in Los Angeles.
If President-elect Barack Obama pauses this week to thank African Americans who came before him, he might tip his hat to some black actors. We're about to meet a writer who explores the connection between Obama and movie stars like Sidney Poitier. In the movie Guess Who's Coming to Dinner, Poitier plays the black fiancé of a white woman whose father is played by Spencer Tracy.
Have you given any thought to the problems your children are going to have?
Yes, and they'll have some.
Is that the way Joey feels?
She feels that every single one of our children will be president of the United States, and they'll all have colorful administrations.
But how do you feel about that problem?
Well, frankly, I think your daughter is a bit optimistic. I'd settle for Secretary of State.
Sidney Poitier in Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. The writer Jabari Asim has been thinking about that kind of character. He wrote a book called What Obama Means. In that book, Jabari Asim describes a type of movie character that is mockingly called the Magic Negro.
It kind of ties into this mythical notion of a certain kind of heroic black character that exists primarily to redeem white American lives.
What is an example of that?
I guess a notable example would be Bagger Vance in The Legend of Bagger Vance, played by Will Smith. Another Michael Clark Duncan in The Green Mile.
Where the black character is not the central character, but he's the guy who moves the white star in the right direction. Is that what you're saying?
Yes.
Let's listen to a little bit of Will Smith acting here with Matt Damon in this movie, Legend of Bagger Vance. Will Smith is playing a golf caddy, and Matt Damon is the guy who's going to benefit from his advice.
The trick is to find your swing.
What did you say?
Well, you lost your swing. We got to go find it. Now, somewhere in the harmony of all it is, all it was, all it will be.
Deeply philosophical bit of practice there, I guess.
Yes, very much so. But I think that it has become a convenient place in movies and in literature for African-American characters to exist. And it's a different kind of stereotype. These are not inferior beings. They're often magical, mysterious beings. But I think they speak to some need in the mainstream American imagination to place African-American figures in a way that makes them beloved and non-threatening, but somehow still defined by others' perceptions of them.
What then gets you from thinking about the Magic Negro as it's described in film and Barack Obama? What's the connection there?
Well, you know, I think Barack Obama in many ways fills that role, but he seems to have some knowledge of how people respond to him. I mean, he doesn't entirely resist this notion that he exists to redeem America. We are the ones we have been waiting for, he says. But at the same time, I think he subverts that stereotypical image because these characters, for all their gifts, are not especially resourceful. They're not especially intelligent. And I think that his ability to marry this mystical notion with real life policy proposals and down-to-earth language, as well as the elevated eloquence that he's capable of, sort of subverts the notion at the same time that he profits from it.
In other words, he has to go beyond that image if he's going to be credible.
Exactly.
Now, what about Sidney Poitier? Why do you end up writing an entire chapter comparing Barack Obama to Sidney Poitier?
Well, it's interesting that when Barack Obama's campaign team first began to do testing in terms of how the public was responding to him, and this was when he was putting together a run for Senate, some of the white women of a particular generation responded in focus groups by comparing him favorably to Sidney Poitier. And at first I scoffed at that. You know, I said, boy, that's a really limited response. But as I began to think about it, it made sense. In many ways, the characters that Sidney Poitier played over the years helped make possible the very idea of black men not only in leading roles but in leadership positions.
I want to come back to that notion of the Magic Negro. And again, that's the film character who helps the white character along in some fashion. Do you think that on some level that there are lots of white Americans who do feel that way about Barack Obama, who are comfortable with him in that particular role in their lives?
Well, I think that there are a significant degree of mainstream Americans who may regard him in that way, but I don't think that it is an entirely bad thing. I think that he can be cast in a heroic way, in a way that provokes admiration and inspiration as opposed to earlier, more negative responses to blackness, and that if it's necessary to embody this particular personality for a while, if it means that it will lead us to more wholehearted and comprehensive notions of what black people are and what they're capable of, then this isn't a bad thing.
Jabari Asim is editor of the NAACP magazine The Crisis and author of a new book called What Obama Means.
You can hear these stories and more on our website, npr.org/movies.